On this week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about autopilots that aren't ready for prime time, lessons from Black Hat, and how streetlights could be the answer for better 5G. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 457 for August 20th, 2021, 5G Streetlights.
This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Thinks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT. How do you hear about us, Fox? And by Akamai. Akamai is the world's largest distributed edge compute platform. Deliver and protect your digital experiences worldwide. Tap into Akamai for its unrivaled intelligence, performance, and scalability. Visit akamai.com/enterprise today to learn more. And by FlexTrack. A powerful yet simple security management platform that helps you to get the real cybersecurity work done. With FlexTrack, you'll streamline your assessments, analytics, and reporting. Visit FlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month.
Welcome to Twyatt. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, and we have another great episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech coming straight at you. Now, you will have noticed, if you're a long time or even a somewhat occasional listener or viewer, that I am not our normal host, Lou Maresca. He is off on assignment, but will be back with us next week. In the meantime, you have me and our co-hosts. Want to get right into welcoming them. First, we have the Geek in Paradise and my nearby neighbor, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, what's happening down in your end of the neighborhood?
Well, I'm having a great time unpacking. I finally set up the sound system for that brand new 82-inch monitor that's now my TV, which is pretty fun. And working with an architect on seeing if I can go and change my screen room into a full-on studio, which would be a lot of fun. But other than that, I am enjoying adjusting to the Florida Sunshine State, and I've changed from one paradise to another.
Well, I love your television set, and I know you're an architect, so I know you're having fun with both. Speaking of having fun, we're welcoming a new co-host, or rather a returning co-host, to Twyatt, Mr. Oliver Rist, an executive editor of business over at PCWeek.com. Oliver, welcome back to Twyatt.
Hi. Glad to be here.
It is good to have you back, and I apologize. I said PC Week. It's PCMag.com. Tell us what kind of stuff you do at PCMag.com.
Well, considering PC Mag is focused mainly on consumer stuff, I basically do everything that they consider boring. So anything to do with business, IT, mostly SaaS service type software, that we review it, we write about it, we're happy about it, and I'm probably the most business nerdy guy there.
A business nerdy guy and the king of what many people think of boring, you're right at home here on Twyatt.
Damn straight.
We have a great guest today. We're going to be talking about providing wireless access, especially to underserved communities. A lot of potential and a lot of need there. So we've got a great guest. Before we do that, though, we've got a couple of sections of news to bring you, so let's get right into the blips. Well, we begin with ransomware attackers who are taking a different tack. They're offering employees a cut if they'll install Demonware on their organization's systems. Crane Hasseld, director of threat intelligence for email security firm Abnormal Security, since August 12th has been interacting with a would-be attacker who he believes is a Nigerian-based business email compromise, or BEC, scammer. That's based on the intelligence he's gathered and gleaned from their online interactions. The scam they've been discussing? Well, it's somewhat reminiscent of a more targeted ransomware attempt on Tesla last year, where cyber criminals tried to bribe an employee at the car maker's Gigafactory in Nevada to the tune of $1 million to help infect the company's network with ransomware. That employee instead worked with the FBI to help get the cyber criminal, a Russian national, arrested. Now, in this case, the attacker apparently initially attempts to dupe his victims using the usual BEC method of gathering contact info on LinkedIn and sending phishing emails to senior-level executives in hopes of stealing credentials and getting account access. Hasseld says senior-level when the credential phishing failed, the attacker pivoted to a ransomware attack deal-making scheme offered via an email message. The attack would go like this. The employee receives an email offering $1 million in Bitcoin, or 40% of a $2.5 million ransom bounty, if he or she will install Demonware ransomware, either physically or remotely, on their company's Windows server or other computers. If the employee wants to take them up on it, he or she contacts the attacker via their Outlook email address or Telegram account provided in the initial email. Now, Demonware ransomware, aka Black Kingdom, is available on GitHub for download, but the attacker told Hasseld he had written the ransomware himself using Python. This ransomware has been most famously used to exploit the proxy login vulnerability in Microsoft Exchange earlier this year. Now, Hasseld said the attacker reassured him that all files would be encrypted and not to worry, because even if the victim pays up and the files are decrypted, they won't know it was his doing. He told me, once I've installed the ransomware, then just put the .exe file in the recycle bin and delete it, and everything will be fine, Hasseld said. That naive comment demonstrates how little the attacker knows about digital forensics and incident response. Now, while rogue insiders are much less common than a pure BEC attack attempt, this scheme underscores how many cyber attacks don't entail malicious payloads coming in via email. It's more about social engineering attacks these days. Hasseld added that this is a great example of a less technically sophisticated attack that relies mainly on social engineering.
Speaking of Tesla, oh my. U.S. government regulators are opening an investigation into Tesla's autopilot system after cars using the feature crashed into stopped emergency vehicles. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration announced the investigation today, and it encompasses 765,000 Teslas sold in the U.S., a significant fraction of all the company's sales in the country. The agency says the probe will cover 11 crashes since 2018. The crashes caused 17 injuries and one death. The NHTSA is looking at Tesla's entire lineup, including the models S, X, 3, and Y from model years 2014 to 2021. It's investigating both autopilot and traffic-aware cruise control, a subset of autopilot that does not steer the vehicle but allows it to match traffic speeds. In each of the 11 crashes, Teslas have hit first responders' vehicles that have been parked and marked with flashing lights, flares, illuminated arrow boards, or road cones. So I, for one, would love to see self-driving vehicles someday, but such reports make me wonder if perhaps this was rushed into production and should have had a lot more testing before being made public.
A couple of days ago, Intel opened up on the next-gen CPU, Alder Lake. And we have a sister site called Extreme Tech, and those very smart people held my hand and walked my feeble brain through it. I like it. It's definitely move up for Intel, mainly because it's finally getting off 14 nanometers and down to 10 nanometers, which is huge since they've been apparently taking many years too long to do that. But is it enough? I don't know. So the trick that Gelsinger is facing, and he's apparently betting the whole farm on it, is that Intel with this is not going to choose either foundry partnerships or internal foundry production. They're going to do both. So according to this week's details, they'll be building their own silicon, and they're also licensing x86 designs and foundry resources to anyone that might want to buy. Investors don't like that, at least some of them, but I kind of get Gelsinger's position, since Biden just announced he's going to pump $52 billion into USA chip production. So I'm with Gelsinger. This isn't the time to close the door on anything. But the whole thing really hinges on whether Alder Lake is going to be competitive or not. And let's not go into too much nerd detail, but basically Alder Lake has taken a tip from Apple and has split itself into two basic cores. Grace Mount is the one that's more exciting, in my opinion, because that's the low-power architecture. The other one is called Golden Cove, all-new architecture. That's the high-end. Golden Cove, it's like Peter Fonda in On Golden Cove. If the cores live up to the hype, competitiveness is basically a given, at least for Grace Mount. So Grace Mount, they're claiming 80% more performance over what you get with two Skylake cores, but with 80% less power consumption. They've been really weak in the mobile CPU market for a long time. That should put a dent in that. That's really good. Golden Cove, they're being a little more close to the vest with that one. Lots of techno babble, but at the end of the day, they're claiming 1.19x median performance boost over what you get with a high-end Rocket Lake. That's good. It's respectable, but I'm not 100% sure that's going to make people rush the order site. Again, though, this is all pre-delivery. No one's done any benchmarks. No one's even seen or touched one of these things. And you're not going to see one until what they're saying is, quote, the last quarter of 2021, unquote. But like that's 6 weeks away. So I don't know, probably going to be like the last month of the last quarter of 2021. I like the new strategy. I think the company is very confident in its claims. So that's making me feel good about it. But frankly, they better be confident because they got a lot riding on this one.
Speaking of companies that have a lot riding on something, T-Mobile is continuing to investigate a breach that has now affected more than 50 million current, former, and prospective customers. This week, they confirmed at least 5.3 million more customers were affected in its most recent data breach, the details of which have been emerging slowly since it confirmed the attack on August 16. Earlier this week, T-Mobile revealed data from approximately 7.8 million current T-Mobile postpaid customer accounts was compromised in the attack. The data compromised included their first and last names, dates of birth, social security number, and driver's license or ID information. In addition, data from about 40 million former or prospective T-Mobile customers was exposed, including first and last names, dates of birth, social security numbers, and driver's license ID information. Now, the company has also determined phone numbers as well as IMEI and IMSI information, or the usual identifying numbers associated with mobile phones, were also compromised. It also reported the attacker accessed 5.3 million current postpaid customer accounts that had one or more associated customer names, addresses, dates of birth, phone numbers, and IMEI or IMSI. Official noted that the additional accounts didn't have their social security numbers or driver's license ID data exposed. Woo-hoo to that. In a statement, T-Mobile said, quote, "We continue to have no indication that the data contained in any of the stolen files included any customer financial information, credit card information, debit, or other payment information," end quote. In other words, it includes every piece of personal information possible except their credit card number. Thank heavens, I suppose, for the smallest of favors. Well, that is the blips. We have a special edition of Bytes coming up. But before we talk about Bytes, we have to go back to Lou Maresca talking about one of our favorite Twiat sponsors.
Thanks, guys. We'll get you back to your Enterprise and IT news in just a moment. Before we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Thinks Canary. And the last thing anyone wants or needs right now is a data breach. Rather than the villain lying in wait, you have a hero, and that's Thinks Canary waiting for them. Now, companies usually find out too late they've been compromised, even after they've already spent millions of dollars on IT security, and they find out it wasn't enough. Now, Canary has completely changed the game. It's designed to be installed and configured in minutes and, pardon the pun, left to its own devices. You don't have to think about it at all. Now, attackers prowling a target network look for juicy content. They browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares looking for documents. They'll try default passwords against network devices and web services and will scan for open services across the network. Now, Canaries can be deployed throughout your entire network and you make them look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've been caught. Now, things Canaries are designed to look like the things the hackers want to get into. Now, you can put fake files on them or enroll them in Active Directory. Now, when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified. Now, you can also use Canary tokens, and these are tiny tripwires that you can drop into hundreds of places. They follow the Things Canary philosophy of trivial to deploy with a ridiculously high quality of signal. Now, if an alert happens, Canary will notify you in any way you want. Plus, you won't be inundated with those false alarms that you get sometimes. Now, get alerts by email or text message on your console, Slack, webhooks, syslog, or even just their API. Now, choose the option that works best for your business. Now, it's important that companies know two things when it comes to data breaches. One, hackers will usually take the path of least resistance, and that's right, your people, your staff. And two, it takes on average 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. Now, that's too long, and Things Canary solves that problem for you. Now, the people behind Canary have been in the security game for almost two decades and have trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks. And that's the knowledge they use to actually build Things Canary. Now, Things Canaries are deployed all over the world on all seven continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you'll get five Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How to Hear About It box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love your Things Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Things Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate that. Now we're going to talk about something special. Normally, the bites are when we take a particular news story, tell you about it, and then dig in a bit. But this time, we're going to talk about an event that happened a couple of weeks ago. I was at the Black Hat and DEF CON conferences live and in person this year, as opposed to last year, which was purely virtual. So what was it like? What did I hear? What was going on? First, about the conferences themselves. Both of these were what the organizers call hybrid conferences. That means that while there was an in-person component, now that's both the conference and the exhibit floor, there was also an online component so that people who could not or didn't want to travel didn't have to. In talking with show management, both of the conferences consider this hybrid approach to be really successful. And while I have no particular insight on these, I will say I think it is highly likely that future conferences of this type will be hybrid. The last couple of years have shown the show organizers that they don't have to worry about the online conference cannibalizing the in-person event, making people not want to come. And that was really the next thing that I was going to talk about, the fact that people really did want to meet face-to-face. It was almost a palpable craving that people had to be in person once again. Now, this is very understandable. It's also the source of some danger, because it means, in one instance, that people, if we do get another variant that forces the public health officials to say we should be locked down, people are going to be very reluctant to do that. People want the human face-to-face contact. It has also opened up another attack vector for social engineering attacks, because in the same way that people want to be really rich and they want to feel like they're powerful and they want to feel like they're helping their company or their customers, they really, really want to be face to face with other human beings, even if both of those faces have masks on them. And at both of the conferences, all of the faces did have masks on them. Both conference organizers said that these were fully masked events. For those of you keeping score, the employees and staff at casinos, restaurants, bars, etc. in Las Vegas were also fully masked. That is by order of their health department. So with that about the conferences, what did I see there? Because normally, of course, we're talking about all the new technologies, the new trends, the various, you know, phases of technology sweep going on. So what were we talking about? Here's the thing that people weren't really talking about. That's ransomware. Why were people not talking about ransomware? I think a big part of it is that ransomware is now right up there with something like a sin flood. It's just part of the environment. People assume that there are going to be ransomware payloads in email messages coming to their organization every single day. They assume that there are going to be ransomware payloads attached to URLs on sketchy websites every single day. So what they're doing is using automated means to try and guard against those attack vectors, while they spend most of their time helping employees recognize and respond appropriately to the sorts of URLs, attached files, etc., that might come to them in spear phishing campaigns. So one of the traits was education and awareness. Talk to a number of companies that are heavily into the awareness and training spaces, and they are seeing a huge uptake in business. Some of this is related to the fact that more employees are working from home. Some of it is related to the fact that the IT department and security groups are recognizing that they must have trained, aware employees as one of the first lines of defense. One of the other things that we found out is that, just as in the case of wearing a mask, it's not necessarily because it protects you, but it's protecting everybody else, because both immunology and IT security aren't just about you anymore. You're part of an ecosystem. You're part of a supply chain. In fact, you're probably, as an organization, in the middle of a supply chain. You have all of your suppliers going off one side and all of your customers and partners going off the other. In the middle is where you sit. Now, you want to do what you can to do your due diligence and make sure that your suppliers, your partners, are all as secure as they can be. And that means doing things like third-party security checks, third-party risk assessments. Risk assessments are growing. You're hearing about them much more often because they put security in the language of the boardroom, risk factors, and ultimately dollars. But you have to be prepared for your customers and your partners to have the same sort of very pointed, difficult conversations with you that you're having with your suppliers and your partners. No one is alone anymore in the cybersecurity world. It's all part of a chain. So preparing people to be part of the security team through awareness training, third-party security, those are two big things. And one of the third that I like to talk about You know, over the past 2 or 3 years, we've heard a lot of people say that the perimeter is dead. There is no more perimeter. I think they're wrong. Perimeter still exists, but the perimeter is an abstraction layer. Just as cloud computing doesn't do away with servers, it merely turns the compute into an abstraction layer that goes after the functions and the services provided by the servers. So the perimeter still exists, is still very real, but it is an abstraction layer rather than something that's defined by physical walls and a firewall. And the sooner IT departments learn that the perimeter hasn't gone, that it's just abstract, the safer they'll be. Now, I want to bring my co-host in to get their take on some of these. And Oliver, since you're the new guy on the panel, I'm going to go to you first.
Awesome.
Are any of these things that you've heard about? I mean, are you hearing about supply chain security? Are you hearing about the shifting definitions of perimeter? What are you hearing from where you sit?
The last ransomware discussion I had was actually with Microsoft, and it sounded a little bit like the proverbial bovine excrement. My last deal with them was obviously Windows 365. So that's the new darling. Everybody wants to do desktop as a service because it theoretically solves all your hybrid work problems. And the line the guy gave me, it's not part of their official messaging, but he put it out there. You know, your security on a Win 365 desktop is going to be improved against certain attacks, including ransomware. And again, I'm not a coder, but like you said, it's still a desktop. It's at an abstracted layer. I forget whether that's 4, 5, or 6, but it's definitely up there. However, the entire network, that's what they don't tell you about Win 365, unless you're, you know, an individual, you're building a software-defined network to run those things. So maybe Brian knows. I can actually kick this off to Brian. Like, in my mind, theoretically, some Yahoo clicks on the wrong link inside a Windows 365 desktop, you can still get hit by ransomware, no?
Oh, yeah. And it's the virtual network, but it's still a network. And the other problems is a lot of these virtual networks default to what's called promiscuous mode, so it can listen and hear all kinds of things, and they do that for monitoring, which is all fine and good, but that is a risk factor. So anyway, my bottom line on this is it might be virtual, but it's still a computer. Remember that old meme that was going around? The cloud is really someone else's computer. That's what you've got to keep telling yourself that.
Exactly.
It's just someone else's computer.
Yeah. I totally agree.
So there's going to be a lot of discussion, a lot of people throwing out market speak, but it's just someone else's computer, and we need to use the same kind of rules, the same kind of common sense that doesn't seem to exist anymore. And, you know, no matter how good we do things, someone clicking on the wrong email still can bypass an awful lot of security.
Yeah.
You know, you're right. That notion that human beings are a critical part of security can't be overlooked. It seems like the last decade we have spent a lot of time, effort, and most of all money trying to come up with ways to work around the human part of security. And the fact is, we can't. You cannot simply ignore. There is no level of zero trust. There is no level of authentication numbers. There is no technology that will allow a user, an employee, to go clicking on everything that they get, opening every file that comes to their desktop, and leaving the enterprise completely secure. It just isn't possible. So I think that one of the things we're going to be talking about over the next year or so is that human factor. We're going to see many more people talking about the training. We're going to see many more people talking about incorporating user behavior into their security. Speaking of behavior, that's an authentication factor that we're hearing more and more about. Behavioral authentication is something that seeks to minimize the friction for the legitimate users while keeping the friction high for the potential attackers. It's all interesting. It's all going to continue. And I'm looking forward to bringing the Twiat Riot more from in-person events in the future. I've got another one I'm going to in September, something called IWCE about emergency and critical infrastructure communication. We'll be talking about that. And it'll be interesting to see whether I'm heading off to Black Hat Europe in a few months. One way or the other, there's going to be plenty to talk about. Look forward to talking about it with you. Well, that is it for our special edition Byte. We have a super guest coming up. But before we can talk to our guest, we have to toss it over to Lou once again for another great Twiat sponsor.
Thanks, guys. Well, I'll get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just a moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week, Enterprise Tech, and that's Akamai. Now, when you're in software and services like I am, you always think scale and you always think Akamai. Now, I've been using Akamai for many years, starting by using their unparalleled CDN support, especially for large files that require that really low latency when I access them. Now, we talked a lot about microservices on the show and how it's really the service of choice, the architecture of choice for organizations. Imagine not having to think about scale for those services. Now, edge computing brings your software and services as close proximity to you and end users as possible. And that's where Akamai is the platinum standard here. Now, Akamai is the world's largest distributed edge compute platform. Ask yourself something. Would you like to deliver extraordinary customer experiences and run code at the edge? Well, Akamai is your answer, and it is truly powerful because Akamai has 10 times the locations of the nearest competitor. That's over 4,000 locations. You're always closer to your end user with Akamai, significantly cutting down on latency. Now, Akamai will also greatly improve your customer experience as well. Your customers will get the content, apps, sites, and video they need without lag, interruption, or latency during unexpected traffic spikes. Now, prepare for spikes in demand and optimize resources to provide the best experience for your customers. Now, you'll be amazed at Akamai's unparalleled performance. Now, you'll always be one network a hop away from 85% of the world's internet users. Now, what about scalability? Let's talk about that for a second. Well, application architects get the flexibility to scale their enterprise applications with Akamai Edge Workers. Now, with Edge Workers, your development team can focus on building while letting Akamai take care of the challenges of scaling globally. And because Akamai empowers you to deploy serverless code at the edge, so you want to experience those headaches of increased traffic at origin or the overheads that go along with it. Now, Akamai gives you the power to innovate right at the edge because your logic and functions are deployed and active at the nearest proximity to your end users. You're getting the fastest end user experience around the globe. Now, Akamai makes it simple to build right at the edge using JavaScript so you can innovate in real time. Now, you get low latency access to data for custom code at the edge. And Akamai can optimize your API traffic delivery for edge applications. But what's the cost? Well, even with its unrivaled intelligence, performance, and scalability, Akamai is comparatively priced. Because limits are set per request, you can be sure your workload will scale no matter the size of your business or user base. And being serverless means you'll see decreased overhead at origin too. Now, you know Akamai and their reputation, they are trusted by the biggest brands in the world, and you're getting 10 times the locations of competitors for the fastest customer experience available. So check out the Akamai website to learn more about edge computing, even have a conversation with them. You might be surprised just how competitive the pricing is. Build closer to your end user with Akamai, the world's largest distributed edge compute platform. Visit akamai.com/enterprise to learn more. That's akamai.com/enterprise. And we thank Akamai for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We'll be seeing you again before the end of the show. But now it's time for my favorite, and I think everyone's favorite part of This Week in Enterprise Tech, our guest. This week, our guest is Ian Aaron, CEO of Ubiquia, a company involved in bringing wireless service to underserved areas through something called microcells. We're going to be talking with Ian about who they're serving and how they're serving them. Ian, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Curtis, thanks for the time today. Pleasure to meet you. And it was great to hear your blips and bytes.
Oh, thank you. Well, we're eager to hear about Ubiquia, but before we do, I mean, I was saying in my Black Hat summary that this industry is all about people. So we'd like to hear about you as a person. You're sitting in the CEO's office at Ubiquia. What was the path that brought you here?
Well, I'm originally from Chicago, from the Midwest, and I ended up going to University of Illinois, where I was an electrical engineer, influenced very much by one of the youngest professors, Dr. Goncharoff, in my curriculum. And I ended up, through the process, I was also a co-op engineer. So every other semester, I was interning with companies in aerospace, and one of them happened to be a telecom company at the time called GTE, which I think now people know it as Verizon. And came up through the ranks of R&D and product development, got offered a job after college in their kind of executive program, and came up through the ranks, getting involved in just about every facet of the telecom industry, and was just an amazing experience, including running product development for a joint venture we had with Fujitsu, building switches, packet data switches, and other things, and just incredible, valuable experience. And I recommend to anybody coming out of school, if they have opportunities to co-op, absolutely take it.
Well, the co-op is a great program for engineers, programmers, and all kinds of technical folks. It's wonderful to hear a CEO who came up through the technical side. And so, you know, let me ask, from the technical end of things, what is so challenging about bringing wireless services to, well, let's call it everyone in the U.S.? Shouldn't we be at a point where the coverage of wireless access is more or less ubiquitous?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because at Ubiquia, we have a mantra, and our mantra is all about making cities smarter, safer, and more connected. And we started out by doing that by leveraging something incredibly simple, and that's the streetlight. And what most people don't understand is that there's 360 million streetlights across the globe, and they all have a common socket, whether you're in Australia, Japan, you know, Brazil, across the U.S., anywhere in Latin America. It's the same socket that originally holds the photocell. And when we started to look at the products that we make to help save energy, help the utilities in monitoring the grid, we saw this socket on a street light that's typically 50 meters apart, 25 to 30 feet high. And we said, along with, you know, the utility sector, there's an opportunity to leverage this asset for communications. So we've built a suite of products that literally disrupt the industry from the standpoint of how small cells are traditionally deployed today versus how we do it. And we've also used that same platform for things like public Wi-Fi and public safety. So when you talk about bringing 5G, you know, into secondary or tertiary markets, this happens to be a 5G small cell, and you can see the manufacturer on that, hopefully. There you go. And this product actually just simply plugs right into the photocell socket. And instead of costly construction permits, there's a single clamp. And this product now is that's probably one of the easiest ways to 5G enable your city. And we did the exact same thing for public Wi-Fi and for private LTE. So we've taken a very different approach versus long permitting processes, putting up fat poles, power supplies, meters, antennas, everything that I just mentioned is fully integrated into this unit.
Well, now that is impressive. And it strikes me that, among other things, the utility poles, the street lights, are at just about the perfect distribution for 5G coverage. But I want to get something clear first. So Ubiquia didn't start as a 5G microcell company. You were doing other things with utility companies before you recognized that this was a business with the 5G. Is that correct?
We recognize that in order to work with the streetlights, we had to endear ourselves to the city and the utilities. And when they convert to an LED light, these LED lights now have the ability to be controlled. They can have schedules, they can be dimmed, but you need to have a controller. So we built a very unique controller that plugs into any of those 360 million streetlights. It actually, instead of legacy mesh networks, it leverages the LTE networks. This little product can operate in 162 countries globally. We can ship it in a single SKU. They can plug it in. It adapts to street lights from 120 to 480 volts, and it can automatically control them. This product's certified also as a meter. So now that you can dim the lights, the city can actually be charged instead of on a bulk basis. They can be charged based on how much energy they actually use. So in a city like San Jose, as an example, they're saving about 40% in energy costs based on the fact that they're using this and can control the lights with schedules and dim them instead of keeping them on or off at 100%.
So I'm seeing your controller for the LED lights. Does that controller go away when you have someone putting a 5G microcell up there, or does the controller piggyback on top of the microcell so the city doesn't lose that capability if a carrier comes in and wants to use the pole?
Everything that's integrated into this device for power metering, light control, it even detects things like power quality at the street side, how much energy the street light uses. Everything that's in here is fully integrated into this device. So you don't need to have it. So the meter certification, all of the power quality protection, the ability to adapt to any street light voltage, 50 hertz, 60 hertz, fully integrated into this device. So you don't need to have this when you put up a 5G small cell.
Well, that is very good. I have more questions, including how anyone would not want to do this in their cities, but I want to bring my co-host in as well, because each of them has their own area of expertise they're going to bring to the conversation. Before I do that, though, we need to bring our regular host into the conversation one last time to tell us about another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, thank you, guys. I'll get you back to your enterprise and IT news in just a moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's PlexTrack. Now, they are the security management platform that brings you better reports, deeper assessments, and more insights. Now, do you spend hours and hours reporting security issues and feel like it's getting you nowhere? Are you buried in data but still can't get a full picture of your security posture to prioritize remediation efforts? We've got the solution for you. That's right. PlexTrack empowers continuous assessment, automated workflow, and effective collaboration between teams to help cybersecurity professionals do more in less time. Now, create assessment reports in half the time and centralize your remediation efforts across all scans, assessments, and audits through powerful risk visualizations, scanner, and ticketing integrations, and enhanced analytics to effectively communicate risks in real time. Now, whether you're red or blue, there is a Plex track for every security professional to save time and get the right work done. Now, for red teams, they can import findings from numerous vulnerability scanners. It can include screenshots and video with auto formatting, create customized templates, and export to Word with just one click. Now, streamline the report writing process to deliver better reports faster. Now, for the blue teams, they can actually customize internal and external assessment questionnaires, synchronize findings with task management tools like Jira Cloud, and assign findings to team members and track status over time, and provide attestation of security posture with robust analytics. Want to learn more? Well, in-person events are back, and the PlexTrack team will be in Las Vegas for Hacker Summer Camp 2021. For those visiting Sin City for Black Hat and DEF CON, give a shout-out to PlexTrack on social if they will see you there. Now, connect with PlexTrack at their hospitality suite and open house to see how PlexTrack fits your unique use case, or simply challenge your skills with their Purple Team CTF. Try PlexTrack free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to plextrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's plextrac.com/twit. And we thank PlexTrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
And it's time to bring the rest of the crew into the conversation. I want to start with Brian. Brian, I know you have had a lot of experience both with public utilities and with wireless communications. So I'm sure you have a number of questions you'd like to ask Ian.
Well, I'm actually asking more about, you know, some of the trends you might be seeing. Obviously, 2G is pretty much dead in America. 3G is definitely going. Are you starting to see things changing? You know, there's a lot of people putting out LTE to get smaller amounts of data out on a regular basis, but still not break the bank. But I'm also seeing a lot of public safety, people putting in Wi-Fi and surveillance. Are you actually seeing these types of things happening? Are you starting to see people talk to you about things like community wireless?
So when we look at wireless, we see basically three technologies, or let's call it three networks. We see the public LTE network, which is what I showed you, the Ericsson, Nokia, at least in the U.S., providing services for the carriers with remote radio heads and micros. We see now, like what we deployed in Las Vegas with CBRS. So the FCC opened up the 3.5 gigahertz band and the citizens radio band, citizens band radio, and they are allowing cities to use it on an open basis, unlicensed basis. And you're seeing cities start to deploy some private LTE networks in that space. Utilities are also looking at this, but on longer term licenses with Anterix in the 900 megahertz for private LTE. But when you talk about Wi-Fi and public safety, that's exactly why we created this product. So this product is actually a Qualcomm industrial Wi-Fi 6 access point. It's tri-bands. So you can bring backhaul into one of the units and mesh up to four units together. We ended up also have an option where you can get a dual 4K camera and an 8-core neural AI processor with four integrated directional microphones in it. And we're using this as a, call it a hero product for cities, for both bridging the digital divide and helping with public safety all at the same time, or what we'll say public safety and curb management. And like what we showed with the 5G small cell, this is what it takes for public Wi-Fi and public safety. That's the full installation process for installing cameras and a public Wi-Fi access point. So we are, this product is a very exciting product. We're literally deploying them in cities by the hundreds.
Well, I noticed this, that red cap on the top, and your website seems to indicate that there's a stacking port on top. What kinds of things can you stack on that?
So this port that you talk about, sometimes the cities have a legacy controller, and this allows you to actually, this allows you to plug that controller in. It's basically a pass-through from the socket that plugs into the streetlight. But with our units, once again, you don't need it. So the red cap is really just a cover to protect that socket. But it's only needed if you want a pass-through device. Also, you mentioned our units. We have a very, on these seven pins, which is universal around the globe, the three for power and the four for dimming, we have the ability to use two of those pins over two wires. Our UB cell or the hub or our metro small cell provide power and communications to sensors like this. So this is a full EPA gases, particulates, temperature, pressure, humidity, air quality sensor. So it does nitrous dioxide, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and ozone. It does 1.0, 2.5, and 10 particulates. 1.0 is smoke. It does temperature, pressure, humidity, but you'll notice a little hole right up here. And that hole is a microphone. So we're also giving cities information about the decibel levels at the street. And we have cities deploying this by the hundreds because all it takes is just a street light and one of our controllers to install versus having to build a separate network and very costly equipment. So it's very exciting. And as I tell people, you know, the smart city sector has been in pilot purgatory. Everything we do from making it easy to deploy and scale is really focused on addressing the fact that cities now can do this at scale, and cities can do it regardless of their size.
Well, Ian, I know that we've been talking about moving into municipal deployments, but you can't talk municipal governments without talking politics and processes. And our other co-host, Mr. Oliver Rist, has some questions about each of those that he'd like to ask. Oliver, over to you.
Hi. Hi. So obviously, if I have my engineering hat on, this sounds great. This is win-win. It's awesome. But I've also worked in a large company, and what sounds awesome can often wind up getting sidelined because of politics. So let's say you guys are going to work with New York City, where I'm living, right? This is Verizon's Mordor. They're Sauron. They're the all-seeing eye. They own this place. Who are you talking to first? Is it New York City? Is it Verizon? Is it both? And who is your end client in that situation?
So we're doing a large deployment in New York, where we're putting in not New York City, another city in New York, where we're working with the utility, and we're putting in 475 of these right now, one at every intersection. And we're doing the same thing with utilities across the U.S. And in fact, on our small cell, we've got collaborating with utilities in Northern California, in Dallas, in Houston. So what we've done is we've literally done a lot of collaboration with utilities to make sure that when cities plug this in, it meets their power protection requirements, their safety methods, installation requirements, their wind and weight loading requirements. So we've done a lot of work with utilities so that when the cities request this kind of technology, they've kind of checked the box. Now, to your point, whenever you get into these larger deployments, it almost always goes through a tender, right? Where there's detailed specifications, there's actually an RFP, there's various large contracting groups that bid on this. And we work with many of those energy services and contracting groups within those types of applications.
Okay. So if I had a follow-up, yes, a lot of the stories I read on you guys had some pretty exciting future directions, you know, artificial intelligence on video, things like that. Sounded very cool. However, I too am a marketing writer, and like I've been writing about smart city pilot projects since 2013. So why do you think smart cities have been in pilot purgatory for that long? Like it's all there. Is it just money, or is it something else?
So we have a mantra: simply connected, simply smart. You know, you've heard people like Cisco say we're kind of moving away from smart city. And when you look at cities, before you put in one of these, you typically had to build a network. And they were primarily, you know, ISM band mesh networks, which have been around for 45 plus years. And, you know, before you could put in this $88 device, you have to go and build a network with, you know, gateways and concentrators, even for the first one of these. Well, we've changed that. And I think what's happened is LTE and NB-IoT and what we do with Cat 1, the price has come down so much over the past 3-4 years where you now can plug this in and be much more competitive. So the network side has really become more competitive to do it. And then we've done a lot of work on the technology so that the energy service companies in the cities can deploy wherever they want at a much lower total cost of ownership. So I think part of it is timing, and part of it really relates to the technology that we built.
Cool. And you, just one last one. We've what installed do you think is the smartest city? Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No, I Go said ahead. We've installed over 200 cities over the past 24 months.
Out of those 200, what do you think is the smartest city overall?
I think Las Vegas has been probably one of the more progressive cities. A lot of great aspirations in what they're doing. San Diego was a leader in putting up, edge AI and cameras 3-4 years ago. They really kind of cut their teeth on early industry, I'll call it deployment, but they've learned quite a bit and they've made some really great use cases, although it's been, very political. But now we're seeing this, any RFP that we see for smart city encompasses light control, public Wi-Fi, video and audio, edge AI, curb management, traffic management. And those are things that we're trying to do with a hero product like this, like our UB Hub with the edge AI.
Well, it sounds great.
Yeah, we're excited. And as you can see from this video, this is our 5G small cell. We've collaborated with the industry. This won the Small Cell Innovation Award this year. And what you would normally see with a fat pole or with a pole with a power supply and a meter and antennas and the radio, all of this we integrated. And we're based out of Fort Lauderdale. We're about 6-7 miles where Motorola had 4,500 people. And we've been able to hire just a phenomenal world-class team on industrial design, on the electrical side, the mechanical side, and RF. So been really, pleased. I think, Brian, you said you're in the Sunshine State. Well, we're neighbors.
Yeah, actually, it's Kurt and myself both live in Orlando.
We're based out of Fort Lauderdale.
Very good. Well, Ian, we have had a great conversation. There's plenty more we'd like to talk to, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. And so before we go, want to give you a chance, if some of our listeners would like to forward information to their city's planning commission, perhaps want to look into what you're doing, how can they get in touch with your company, find out more?
Well, they can come to ubiquia.com. We've got a fairly significant regional sales force across the U.S. and Latin America, along with channel partners. So we'd love to engage more and talk about some of the solutions we're deploying across the country. I also just wanted to say in closing, you were talking about it earlier, we created a really unique intern program with FAU, with Stella Bartoloma, and she's an amazing dean of the school. We've been hiring some phenomenal engineering students. Many of them are converting to full time, and always open to bringing young, great talent into the company.
Always very glad to hear a company bring on young talent. I think it's not only a good thing to do, but a very wise course for the company as well. We want to thank Ian Aaron, CEO of Ubiquia, for being our guest this week. And of course, we want to thank you for being here, listening to, watching TWIET. You know, as much as we enjoy it, we could not and would not do this without you. Before we go, though, I want to ask each of my co-hosts what's coming up. Oliver, we'll start with you. What's happening with you for the coming weeks? Where can people find the fruits of your labors?
PCMag.com is where they can find the fruits of my labors. And my labors include at least 3-4 articles a week on various esoteric topics. But as far as testing and actually touching cool products goes, we are right in the throes of testing public cloud infrastructure as a service and how that's evolving and where it's going and what's changed. Because the last time we looked at it, I think, was 2017. So that's taking up the lion's share of my time.
We're glad to hear that you're doing that. Look forward to reading that and glad to have you back here on TWIET. Well, Brian, how about you? You are staying busy as well. Where can people find what you're doing and what are you doing down there on your end of the neighborhood?
Well, actually, today I spent going around my grass and my brush with a magnet trying to pick up roofing nails because we're getting a new roof on our house. It's kind of scary how many nails are in a roof. Anyway, other than roofs, I'd love to hear from you folks. We have all kinds of great ideas that are being sent to us. You're welcome to throw them at me using Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. But, you know, you're also welcome to drop me a line. I'm Chebert, spelled Cheebert at twit.tv, sorry. But you're welcome to also drop in on twit at twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. And I want to definitely make a big welcome. Oliver was actually on the show back when Padre was hosting, and he was our show curmudgeon. And you know what? It's been a lot of fun to have him back. Oliver, welcome back to TWIET after a few years.
Several years, but thank you. I really enjoy it.
Well, we're glad to have the full roster back. Glad to have you with us. And be sure to be here again next week when our regular host will be in the chair. We're looking forward to having Lou back in the host chair. I'll be sitting off to the side. We'll look forward to seeing you then. Well, remember, as always, when you want to know what's what in the world of internet and enterprise technology, just keep TWIET.
No ads, just the content. That's what you get when you join Club TWIT. You even get extras like TWIT Plus, our new bonus feed just for members, and exclusive access to the Club TWIT Discord community. Join now for just $7 a month and support TWIT as we continue to create top-notch podcasts you expect and deserve. I'm just getting started, so be one of the first to join as we build Club TWIT from the ground up. You could be an early member. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit to learn more and sign up now. Thanks. We'll